So I will basically only give like a long version of some posters that have been there. So if you've talked to like the poster, to René, who presented like a poster on this, you already know what's going to happen. I just give a couple more few details. And you will also see some parts of a poster which was presented by Jorenz. So yeah, if this sounds familiar, there's no coincidence. Right, so this is the outline of what I'm going to talk about. So I will first tell you about like some simple QPV protocols that we have heard of a lot. So about the F routing protocol and what I call the measuring protocol, or some people call the F function BB84 protocol, or that also appeared already. So I will just tell you a bit like how the security proof works for that, to have an intuition of what we did there, because I mean some people are using these results, so it might be good to sort of like see the proof. Then I will talk about some other results that people have done, like for example Jorenz has done, or René, Philip, Florian, Harry have done concerning, and of course like Wolfgang and Kirsten for the experimental side, towards like having photon loss tolerant protocols, because I mean as we have heard in the talk yesterday by Wolfgang, that's sort of like the main issue to be solved before you can actually do this in practice. And then finally, I will tell you about very new work that hasn't been that is not out yet, and it's ongoing work with René, with Harry, Matthias, Chris, Donald could not be here from Copenhagen, Jorenz, Florian, and Philip, about like how to make like many QPV protocols fully loss tolerant. So not only like I don't know 10% photon loss or 20 or like 65, but like completely. So that's the idea. Sort of like this problem is then hopefully gone. Right. And I hope I get to this. Anyway, so let's start. So the question is like, what do you want from a practically implementable QPV protocol? And probably you want that they are as simple as possible, right? I mean, if you go to an experimentalist and say you have to perform this very huge operation and like 1,000 qubits, and you have to entangle them all and store them for 5 minutes, I mean, they probably say, like, there's the door, please go away. So you want to have something that is as simple as possible, for the honest part is, of course. Then you want something that should, of course, be secure. I mean, that's the whole point. And against as many entanglement as possible. So like let's be modest and say like a linear amount, because I mean, no one can prove anything better so far. And they should be tolerant against photon loss. I mean, this is what we heard yesterday. And so let's try to do that. I hope at the end of this talk, I can convince you that these protocols actually exist. And then you can hopefully go to your lab and just do it. Well, I mean, like, this is a theorist speaking, right? Right, so let's start with some simple QPV protocols. And I think in the beginning, I can go pretty quickly because we have seen those a lot of times. This is this F routing protocol that we've seen a couple of times. So you have two verifiers, V0, V1. You have the prover in the middle. So like I always like think Z maybe the middle, that's easier. And then you send like a string X, you send a string Y, you send a qubit along. The prover should compute this function. And if the function is 0, she should write it back to V0. If it's 1, she should write it back to V1. You already know this protocol. And this actually goes back to the famous paper by Adrian, as far as I know. So it's not us who came up with this protocol, but it's way older. And what the verifiers do for the qubits, they prepare, for example, half of an entangled pair, or you do the unentangled version where they prepare one of the four BB84 states, and they send one qubit, if you do the entangled version, long to the prover. They keep the other one sort of like in a cupboard or so where it's safe. And then in the end, they just perform a Bell measurement on the two qubits that they have, like the one that they got back and the one that they have in the cupboard, and see whether it succeeds or not. To sort of certify that the thing they got back was just not replaced and something random. And that works. So let's see like what we are fighting against, right? I mean, we want to prove that this is secure. So we have to know like what attacks we're actually talking about. I think we haven't seen this yet. So the model looks a bit complicated, but it's not so difficult. I mean, first we have the verifiers here with the system R. That's the cupboard, basically. This is where they put their qubit, like half of the entangled pair that they are not changing. So they are not doing anything. Nothing happens here. And then there's Alice and there's Bob. And each of them has three subsystems. So first there's A and B. That's like a one qubit subsystem where they should put the qubit if they have it. say like Alice intercepts the qubit, she puts this in A. And Bob in principle could do the same thing. I'm like, why not? Then we have the A tilde and B tilde. These are their local qubits, so they can use them for local computation. So those will just stay there, as you can see. And we have A, C, and B, C, where C is for communication, so they can send this over. So I mean, as you all know, there's a one round of communication that they have. So A, Alice can send the A, C to Bob, and B, Bob can send the B, C to Alice. And because we just say, maybe, I mean, it's useful, they also always send X and Y over, and we just don't count this. I mean, this is for free. It's obviously a good idea to do that, so we just don't need to account for that. And so then in the end, Alice will have like A, A tilde, and B, C, because she got it from Bob, and Bob, B, B tilde, and A, C. So what can they do with this? Well, in the beginning, Alice only knows X, right? So she can apply a unitary on her systems. Bob can apply a unitary depending on Y on his systems. And in the end, after communication, Alice has another round where she can apply something on dependent on X and Y, and same for Bob, right? And this is what we're trying to do. And we are all assuming that this is all unitary because you have like Steinspring dilated and just helps with the analysis. Right. So what is the security statement that we have? Well, it's this one. So we assume that the verifiers choose the bit strings uniformly at random, because what else should they do? They have length n. And then there exists a function f on 2n bits to 1 bit with the property that if the number of qubits q that each of the attackers controls, so like Alice has q of them, Bob has q of them, and it's like all this a, a tilde, a, c, if you add them up, that's q at most. If that satisfies, that's at most 1 half n minus 5, so it's at most linear in n. They cannot have like n squared or so. Then the attackers are caught with probability at least 2%. That's not much, but it's not zero. And then you can just do it several times. And moreover, a uniformly random function will do. So I mean, I said like there exists a function, but I don't tell you which function because I can't. But if you take a uniformly random one, this will work. It's not completely desirable because I mean, this might have like exponential circuit complexity. And it's bad in general, but that's at least the security statement. We will come to concrete functions later. And as I said, I mean, you can just boost the probability of success. Success of like detecting the attackers, or, like suppress their probability of success exponentially if you just do sequential repetition. You cannot prove parallel repetition, but sequential is already a start. Of course, you want parallel in the end, but I mean, that's for future work. So now I have like the ambitious idea that I want to present you what the proof more or less looks like. I apologize to our experimental friends. But maybe hopefully you get the idea of it, because I think it's interesting and sort of like helps you understand like what you could improve in the future. And in principle, we are using an idea from this famous garden hose paper of Florian, Harry, and some other people. Because like if you look very carefully and you go to Appendix E, I think, of their paper, you find a result which basically says, okay, like for each state that the attackers can pre-share, there's a function against which this is secure. But this is the other way around, right? You want like a function that is true for every state and not like for every state there's a function. So what you have to do is sort of you have to invert the quantifiers and you have to make like put some epsilon somewhere. So this is what we had to do in this proof. But it follows more or less the same strategy. So if you know the garden hose paper and you've made it to Appendix E, this will look very familiar. Right, so no new ideas here. And right, I mean, we do it in a robust way. And what they have already in this paper is the observation that if you take a state from which the qubit can be recovered on the left, so at V0, and you take a state from which the qubit can be recovered on the right, like in the last step, when you act like on all the systems that Alice has after communication, all the systems that Bob has after communication, because this is what they have to do in the end. I mean, at the very end of the protocol, if it should go to the left, Alice has to sort of pull it out of her head. And if it should go to the right, then Bob has to pull it out of his system somewhere, somehow. And what they prove is that the overlap of the systems cannot be too large. So they have to be reasonably different. And that's a bit like the idea that you want to exploit. Like if you should send to the left, they have to be very different than if you want to send to the right, even before they actually add with the last unitary. So after communication, they have to look very different. And that, okay, I mean, not directly, but if you do some analysis, that implies that actually the attackers have to decide before communicating where the qubit should go. I mean, even before talking to each other, they sort of have to like say, this qubit has to go to the left. well, this qubit has to go to the right. And this is good, right? Because in principle, they can only know after the communication phase, like only because then they have to compute this f of x and y. But at that point, they don't have this. So this looks good. I mean, this looks secure. And now we just need to like do the rest of the analysis and translate it into actual security. And to this end, we sort of want to see an attack as a classical compression protocol, which we call classical rounding. So that's the idea. So we first say like a qubit strategy for this routing protocol is epsilon L perfect if on L pairs of strings x and y. So like, I mean, say L is equal to 2, then it's just like 2 pairs of x and y, maybe x equals to 0 and y equals to 1, and x equals to 2 and y equals to 4. On these pairs, Alice and Bob are caught by the verifiers with probability at most epsilon squared. So at these things, they do very well. If they get these L pairs of questions, they can say with confidence, they can like win the protocol, and they can cheat you. So it's sort of like the smaller the epsilon is, and the higher the L is, the worse for security. That's the idea. And I mean, you can just do it, just put it in math. At the end, you want to like have a state to the left with purified distance at most epsilon. If they should go to the left, and you want to have a purified distance to the actual state of at most epsilon if it should go to the right. Anyway. So now we come to the definition of this classical rounding. So that's a function on 3k bits to 1 bit. And it's an epsilon q classical rounding of size k. I know this is a lot of parameters, but I mean, this will become clearer in the next slide. If for all functions that there could have been, so like, I mean, for each function you have a protocol, so for all of them, for all states that they might share on 2q plus 1 qubits, like the plus 1 is the qubit that the verifiers have, and for all L, and all L, epsilon L perfect qubit strategies for the protocol, there are functions which go from n to k qubits, from n to k qubits on b. So this is like compression of the input, right? You take the string x, you make it smaller. You take the string y, you make it smaller. And then you also take the a lambda, which basically takes the state the state psi and indexes it such that, and you want that these functions sort of satisfy that if you input them in the G with like the compressed X, the compressed Y, and sort of like this index that belongs to the state, you get the value of F on at least L pairs. Sort of like, this is like a sort of like a lossy compression thing, right? Because now the G only takes like 3k bits, and it's sort of like it acts the same as the F on all pairs where the attackers do well. So it's like why you want to say sort of like this G captures in essence like on which inputs the attackers can attack you. So that's maybe a bit obscure, but let's now see like how we construct such a thing. And just to recap, I mean like we know that the verifiers have to decide. The attackers actually have to decide before communicating where the qubit will end up. And now we can use epsilon nets of size 2 to the k. Like epsilon s, just, I mean, you probably know this, sphere, and you just like equidistantly or so put like enough points that everything, all the other points are within epsilon distance of one of these points. And you put this epsilon net to discretize Alice and Bob's unitaries. So like basically you take the set of all unitaries and you discretize this and just say, okay, like anything that is close to that unitary is the same as that unitary. And then you just do that for enough. And you do the same with the initial state. So you just discretize all the states that they could have as well. Or in principle, like all the states of the right size, you discretize. And then you're saying, OK, look, now we need this compression functions. And I know that sort of like Alice will perform a unitary depending on her x, right? And now I'm using the epsilon net and say, OK, if I get x, I just put the label of ux, or like it's the unitary which is closest from this epsilon net. So if it's not quite that, I just like say, OK, I round it sort of and just put the label. Because like the epsilon net is just like a list of labels, basically. And I do the same thing for the y, and I do the same thing for the lambda. I just put always the label of the epsilon net element that is closest. And then from this, if you think about it, I mean, you know the unitary, sort of, up to a certain precision. You know the other unitary up to a certain precision. And you know the state up to a certain precision. But if you know like the unitaries and the state, and I told you that sort of from the action before communication, I know whether it goes left or right, I can decide whether it goes left or right, so I can compute this function. So this is exactly what the idea is, and that concludes the proof. So now we've built an epsilon Q classical rounding for that, and now we can just put all of this together. So we just count. That's already like the core part of the paper of Florian and Harry. I think it's the beautiful observation that counting is super powerful. And so the counting argument is you look at the possible number of epsilon Q classical roundings. If you bound the number of qubits Q that they have at their disposal, like linearly, and then you compare with the number of Boolean functions at 2n bits, which is like double exponential on n, so there's a lot of them. And then you argue that if you take this bound, then most Boolean functions are actually quite far from anything constructed by a classical rounding. But anything like constructed from a classical rounding is like any attack. So there are functions which are basically far from any attack. So that means that they cannot be attacked, right? I mean, that's sort of the whole idea of this. And that you can translate then that Alice and Bob cannot succeed with probability at least 1 minus epsilon because with all these epsilon L perfect strategies on too many input pairs x and y. So this is what you need the L for. Right, and that is the proof, like morally at least. And yes?
Sure. In order to reverse states, I mean initial states and actions, why cannot the actions reverse the states?
Yes, this we also did. It's just like the proof becomes easier with that. The first thing that we did was using embezzlement states and then use some kind of minimax theorem. That's exactly what works. But the proof is much more like, I don't know, it's not as nice as with this. And this has like a nice side effect that later we can also do this for concrete functions. Sort of like the proof also works, and I think it gives you morally the same bound, I mean up to constants probably. Doing this has some advantages. No, but exactly, you have the right idea. It's sort of like, this was the first thing that we thought, okay, like if you want to sort of reverse quantifiers, do embezzlement state, from that you can basically post-process any state that they might start with, and then you sort of use minimax to just like invert like existence and for all quantifier. That's just a very, very good idea. Indeed.
On the third point here, so how can you, what's the argument here for this?
I mean, like it's just like, I mean, you count, right? I mean, you sort of see your possible functions as a cloud of points, right? And then you just mark red, like the ones that you can actually attack. And then you just look for like one of the points that is not red, sort of like reasonably far from all the other ones. That's the idea. Okay. And that's a sort of like your function. In the end, I mean, you don't know which one it is. You just like compare numbers. And then you say, okay, like, I mean, if they are, if sort of like there's a lot more that you cannot attack than you can attack, this, so like the probability of hitting one, if you just take one at random, it's very low. It's as stupid as that. There's nothing that you have to do.
Okay.
Yeah. Anyway. Right. So now I talked to you about the F routing protocol, but I mean, we actually don't want to talk in the remaining part of the talk so much about the F routing. So let's do the measuring instead. And I don't actually know whether someone has actually shown this. I think people have mentioned this. So it's more or less the same protocol. So you still start sending x and y, you still send a qubit. But now at the prover, they have to measure and send back a bit. I mean, this is like this BB84 protocol, but now we still have a function to do this. It resembles the Bagey and Koenig protocol. And the verifiers prepare q randomly as 0 or 1, and then apply a Hadamard if the function evaluates to 1. So basically, you should think about this like h to the f x and y, right? And then the prover measures in the basis specified by f, x, and y. So if it's 0 in the computational basis, if it's 1, she measures in the Hadamard basis, and then sets back whatever she got. And the verifiers check whether this is the b that they actually put in there. So whether if they send 0, it should be 0. If they send 1, it should be 1. And then if it's the right bit, they accept. And so let's compare these two protocols. And the protocol in Bagey and Koenig uses actually n qubits, whereas we only use a single qubit, but we use 2n classical bits. So if you think about like making your protocol as simple as possible, even if like this Thoma Michael et al. Paper in the end proves that sort of you can treat each of these n qubits separately, having one qubit instead of n qubits is definitely better for your experimental friends, because sort of it makes it easier. And we can basically now use like an entropic uncertainty relation, like the most standard one there is, instead of doing this overlap argument that Florian and Harry did to sort of say, okay, like if you want to sort of like send the bit 0, should be very different from sending the bit 1. And then you have to basically modify the proof slightly, but it's still more or less the same proof. You don't have to change that much. It's just like You replace the first part of the argument, and then everything else works as before. And you get the same security. That doesn't really change. So like Q smaller equal than 1/2 n-5. The routing protocol is simpler in the sense that you don't need to measure. I mean, you just need to route. I mean, you can think about this, so you either put a mirror or not. But there's another thing that sort of makes the measuring protocol more attractive, which is that the security proof for the measuring protocol still hopes if the quantum information travels slowly. And as we've learned all from Wolfgang yesterday, if you want to use a fiber, qubits don't actually travel at the speed of light. I studied physics, but I didn't know this. But only at 2/3 of the speed of light, so you better have to deal with that. And like, I mean, sending back is not a problem because you only send back classical stuff. So this is sort of, if you want to use Wolfgang's nice fiber optics, then you better use the second protocol, the measuring protocol, and not the first one. Although the routing is also cool. So like, let's sort of always now think, whenever we see a protocol, we think about the measuring one. That's the one that we want to implement. Before we do this, yes?
Can you comment about the loss sensitivity of the two cases?
Yes.
One, you have to send the qubit twice as far as the other one, so you'll be much more sensitive to loss.
Okay, I think I'm not qualified to comment on this. I will talk about loss sensitivity later.
Okay.
But that's a good question. I mean, we want to get rid of the loss anyway, so maybe this is not so important. But I mean, let's maybe discuss this at the very end. But I'm not sure if I can say much about this.
Okay.
Good. So let's first do like a detour around concrete functions, because I said, I mean, I have to take a random function for this to be secure, which is not so good. But if I want to take a concrete one, like the binary inner product functions, for example, I can basically prove the same thing, but now you have a log n here instead of an n. This is not so good, but this is what you get. Sort of, you have to pay a price for doing concrete things, because the proof is based on communication complexity. I mean, we talked about these classical roundings, which are like classical compression protocols for this function f. So you can see it as a communication complexity protocol. And then if you translate this, you know that this one has maximal communication complexity. And then this translates into this log n bound. We don't think that this should be true. I mean, there should be a better bound, but this is what you get. But you still have like to send one qubit in the honest case, and then now log n at least in the attacking case. So like, you have this trade-off that you can sort of force the attackers to use as many qubits as you like. And then you say, OK, like people can maybe like handle 1,000 qubits. You just make the n 1,000,000, and then you should be good. That's the idea. Right. So now let's go towards loss tolerance. And like first, let's analyze the protocol that we just talked about and conclude why it's not good enough. So what you can do is, like, I mean, your measuring protocol is a bit noise robust in the sense that if you now assume that the prover only succeeds with probability at most at least 99%, I mean, this is pretty high, I know, then you can basically repeat the protocol independently r times, and except if the final measurement is like close to winning r times, say, I don't know, like 90% of these rounds or so. That probably has to be larger. And then you get the statement that if you, again, take a function uniformly at random, then the honest prover still succeeds in the protocol with noise level at most 1%, with probability at least 1 minus c to the r, where c is smaller than 1. So you make r larger. This becomes pretty close to 1. And the attackers controlling at most that many qubits as before, they will succeed with probability at most c prime to the r, where still c prime is smaller than 1. So this becomes pretty fast, close to 0. So it's like a bit noise tolerant, but only against 1% noise. This is definitely not what we want.
Yeah. That 1%, that seems totally arbitrary.
That is totally arbitrary. We come next slide. Then the proof is just like a Chernoff bound. So it's some kind of a concentration of measurement phenomenon going on here. So you have to ask about the, I mean, the advantage is like sort of the noise robustness of 1% holds against anything. So we just basically analyze, OK, if I now put like if I allow this error epsilon, it still has to be like sort of smaller than the probability of attackers to sort of be detected. So I mean, this was pretty, to succeed, which was pretty high. So like, this has to be pretty small. But if you push the numbers, because as you said, it's very arbitrary. I mean, we did this to sort of get a nice number. But if you really like put your mind to it and go through the proof and see what you can prove, you can do it to 6%. But still, I mean, like 6% is sort of, I mean, this is an artifact of the proof, right? I mean, this is where this comes from. Sort of, if you put all the bits and pieces on the epsilon nets, at some point, like, everything starts overlapping and you cannot say anything anymore. This is basically what happens. At some point, your proof breaks down if it's 7%. So that doesn't actually help you, right? I mean, you, you want, of course, not 1% and not 6%, but maybe, I don't know, 90%+ or so, if you want to demonstrate this as a, at a reasonable distance, or maybe even more. And you also know that at 50% photon loss, then the attackers can just simply guess, like, for example, choose a basis, just measure in the spaces, and then let's check, like, if it's, they guess the wrong basis, they just pretend to have lost the photon. So we can never do better than 50% loss, so we will never reach the 90% or whatever your experimentalist friends tell you. So this proves the protocol perfectly. Yes?
Are you equating noise and loss? I mean, 'cause they're two.
No, at the moment I am, but this is sort of like where this, what will help us in the end. It's sort of like here, this this holds against any kind of noise. I mean, loss, other mistakes, whatever. But now we want to treat photon loss differently from all the other ones. Because photon loss is like a different thing than just saying, like, sort of for some reason, the prover doesn't succeed in the protocol for whatever reason this is. Maybe she didn't get the photon. Maybe she, like, had dark counts. Maybe she had, like, I don't know, the detector didn't click. Whatever. Yeah, exactly. This is exactly the point. Now we want to sort of, like, treat photon loss differently from all the other errors, and then we can hopefully get something better. Perfect. Good. So there have been protocols around which do this. For example, the protocol that Wolfgang told us about, the SWAP protocol, which has been analyzed, for example, in the work by René, Philip, Florian, and Harry. I will not talk too much about this. It's just like to remind you, it was based on the SWAP test, and the verifiers send states with a known overlap, and then compare statistics, sort of what they get. And this is a fully loss, photon loss tolerant protocol, so no matter how much photon loss you actually have. And it's secure against unentangled attackers with quantum communication. So it's almost as good as we want, but I mean, this unentangled attackers is not, it's not nice, sort of. We need something better. But it can do parallel repetition, which is awesome, which we can't do. And it's sort of practically feasible, apparently, because I mean, like, Kirsten and Wolfgang have done it, more or less, you know, yeah, or in the process of doing it. So, yeah. But I mean, as it can be broken with a linear amount of EPR press, this is not so good. So we want something better. And if you have talked to Jorenz during the poster session, there is something else that one can do. For example, one can try to make this measuring protocol at least partially loss tolerant. And this is what has been done in this paper by Jorenz and Florian. They've analyzed the measuring protocol under photon loss. So now, like, treating photon loss differently from all the rest. And the first result is that you have a, you can write down a security region for the protocol with just like f of x and y being y. So this is like the BB84 type protocol without the function, basically, and unentangled attackers. And then they can use like a form of monogamy of entanglement games now with loss and some modified NPA hierarchy stuff and combination of like just a guessing and an optimal attack to sort of prove what the security region is. And they can basically show there's a region in which the protocol is secure. There's a reason in which the protocol is insecure. For example, here at this 50% loss starts becoming insecure. And this is like the rest of the errors that can happen. And they can basically write you down this whole region. And sort of like for that, you have understood everything. So now you can say, OK, unentangled attackers is not great. What do we do? Well, they still have something about that. So the previous protocol is insecure if attackers share an EPR bit. But you can now put the function f back, because before I just said it's like f of x and y equals y. That's not the most secure function. But now they can basically prove that it's like, we have proven that it's without loss, it's secure against a linear amount of entanglement. They basically repeat the same proof to show that with loss still works. And then you get a region like that. So sort of you know a region in which this protocol is secure, still stops at 54% or so. There's an unknown region where you don't know what actually happens, and there's a region where this is definitely insecure. So now there's like this white region on your map where sort of there'll be dragons, you don't know. But it's sort of like already giving you some partially loss tolerant things. And if you sort of have a very good fiber and you only want to do it like 4 meters long, then maybe this is good enough. But this is of course not what we want. So, but before I finish, I just mentioned the third result of this paper, which is very nice. So, I mean, we saw that we have this fundamental barrier at 50% loss. But one thing that you can, for example, do is you can just increase. Because the attackers can just guess the bases, how to go beyond that? Well, I mean, like, you just use more than two bases. Because, I mean, like, if you have two bases, you guess one of them, 50% chance of being right. If you have three, it's only like 33%, or like 1/3. So that's the idea, and the result is that this actually works, and you can go to lower eta. I mean, the downside is like it becomes experimentally maybe more challenging as well. I mean, like, I'm not doing any claims here. It just looks more complicated than before. And still, like, you have a sort of like, at some point, this stops. It's not fully loss tolerant either way. So this is the last part that I want to tell you. This is the new part, or like the ongoing part, with basically half of this conference. And so half of the conference will be bored because they already know this. And so I want to sort of like now show you the statement and give you an intuition of what challenges there are and like how they can be overcome. Right. So now we modified the protocol a bit. It looks very much like what you had before. It was also the figure that René had on his poster. So let's go through this. So at some like the verifier V0 here still sends the qubit. It doesn't look like it originates with him, but it's just like because it's a slow qubit. So it has been sent from like way in the past, and then at some point it arrives at the prover. So can be through a fiber, can be like by mail or whatever. Doesn't matter how slow it is, and it arrives at the prover. The prover sort of knows when this should arrive, and then what the prover has to do is she has to check, did I actually get this qubit or not, and has to say like if she got it, she sends back c equals to 1. If she didn't get it, she sends like c equals to 0. So she has to like commit to playing or to like doing this protocol before she actually gets x and y. And that's the whole idea. So sort of like morally shouldn't be able to exploit the fact that you can just say like if you didn't like the outcome, you can say I didn't get the qubit, because you have to say that before. But I mean, you want to not wait forever. So like shortly after you have mailed your qubit, you send the x and you send the y. So you don't wait for the reply. And then they arrive shortly afterwards, like after this delta time. And then you send back the OK, I called this A, I think here we call it, we call this B, it's the same thing. I mean, like you send back the result of the measurement that you performed in the right basis, hopefully. Right, so like the new step is this commitment step. So this commitment bit C is new. And as I said, if the qubit is received, the C is 1. If the qubit is not received, it's 0. And the strings arrive slightly later after this delay. And the idea is it eliminates this transmission loss eta V. So everything that you now have is in terms of problems is just problems at the prover. Like maybe the detectors don't work as expected. They have dark counts. They sometimes don't click. Like everything that stays, we cannot reel this out. But at least you can make now your fiber as long as you want, as long as your prover sort of has good gear in her lab. And yeah, exactly, the only loss at the prover remains because we assume that everything, the classical communication is mostly error-free, which I think is like a reasonable assumption. So the challenge now, like what do we have to prove? So the point is that now the attack is, when they, for example, they sit here and they have to send back the qubit C, they already got the X. So now before committing, like Alice can do something to the state depending on X. And before committing, Bob can do something on the state depending on Y. So in principle, they don't start with like the same state always, which we assumed in the protocol before. They share some state and then they do stuff. But now they can state with the state rho x and y. And this is bad because it's not sort of like, not in the definition of where our protocol is actually secure. So we have to argue that this rho x, y can basically be replaced by something fixed. So this is basically what the challenge is. And now like everything I want to tell you in the rest of this talk is like how we overcome this challenge, or like overcome this problem, we solve this challenge. And we already saw yesterday, I forgot in whose talk we actually saw this. Someone mentioned quantum instruments. Eric did, very good. So I just like expand a bit on that. As you have heard, like a quantum instrument is just like a collection of completely positive max summing to a quantum channel. So like they don't have to be trace preserving, but they are trace non-increasing. And if you add them all, they become trace preserving. And we call them here like I of C. So C is the commitment bit. So like it's like a measurement. It gives you this bit. And like Alice has one and B and Bob has one. So these are the sort of instruments that we want to study. And you should think, I mean, if you're not familiar with this formalism, you should think about this as a measurement with a post-measurement state. So usually you just measure something and you assume the state is gone. But now sort of it also tells you what was left. In principle, like you have a lot of freedom there. That's a bit of a problem. So that's a nice result by, I don't know by whom actually, it can be found in textbooks as like Hayashi's, for example. I think it's rather old and I didn't know it. So it's like the insight I had during this project. that there's a theorem which basically tells you, okay, what could this instrument be, like in a manageable way. And it says if you have an instrument with, I don't know, finitely many outcomes, and MI is sort of the POVM corresponding to this instrument, because like, as I said, any instrument sort of like has a measurement. So if you apply the dual map to the identity, you get this POVM element. Then for every index I, there exists a quantum channel epsilon I, like now an actual quantum channel. Before, like, it was trace non-increasing, now it's trace preserving. And there's a special type of measurement that you perform. Like you sandwich the state from the left and the right, or left and the right, by the square root of this POVM. So if you think like projections from the left, projections from the right, this is like what ordinary quantum mechanics tells you. And this very much helps us, because now we can just absorb this guy into our protocol. Because I mean, like, if you do spline spring dilation, that's just the unitary, and it depends on X for Alice, it depends on Y for Bob. This was exactly what the attackers could do before, so we can throw that away. And we just have to deal with this measurement here. So the measurement can change the state, but now it can change it in a sort of well-defined way. Right, so I mean, as I said, when we commit, we can absorb the quantum channel into the protocol, and we need to deal with the measurement. So this is what we will do now. And now, how do you argue that a measurement doesn't change the state very much? Well, there's something called the gentle measurement lemma, and this is what we want to use. So Alice and Bob can perform POVMs MAX, so like depending on X, and MBY, like Bob can depend on Y, to decide the commitment. And this is sort of what you have to now show, what they can do with this. And the intuition is Alice and Bob actually cannot just say arbitrary things, right? They're not that powerful. Because if Alice says, OK, let's play, and Bob says, no way, so if Alice sends 1 and Bob says 0, then they're definitely detected, because an honest prover would never do that, right? I mean, they should say the same bit, not something different. So if Alice and Bob may not commit differently, then they can actually use X and Y. Because I mean, like, if they use X, I mean, Bob doesn't know X, right? I mean, you sort of like just Alice just says, OK, let's send X. Then Bob says, OK, what the fuck? I mean, like, I don't know what you're doing. So like, you better not use this one. So this is the intuition, and now we need to make this precise. And yeah, I mean, the gentle measurement lemma is sort of a well-known tool. I actually don't know who proved it first, but it's been around for forever. I know. I will not commit to this. You can look it up. And so like, if you have a measurement with two outcomes only, which we have, like, I mean, C equals to 0, C equals to 1, and the measurement is such that it accepts with almost 1, so like 1 minus epsilon, then the post-measurement state, so like just like this square root of m rho square root of m, and you just not renormalize, because if you don't divide by this, you get something that doesn't have trace 1. So you have to renormalize by the probability of actually measuring that. And then it fulfills the sort of difference between the state you had before and after measuring is 2 square root of epsilon. So say the you always succeed, then they are the same. They cannot change. And this is what we want to use. So now we just do it in 2 steps, and then sort of this should help us. So what we have is now we have a post-measurement state which does 2 measurements, right? But the measurements commute, so it doesn't really matter in which you do first, which makes your life easier. You don't need very advanced things. And you still renormalize. And then using the gentle measurement, like very straightforwardly, we can prove the following thing. If you have 3 inputs, x, y, x prime, y, and x prime, y prime, we're just like the ordinary bit strings, then the probability of answering different commitments for all these 3 pairs is upper bounded by some epsilon. So the probability of saying wrong things is upper bounded by epsilon. Then also like the difference between rho of x, y, and rho of x prime, y prime is at most 8 square root of epsilon. So this is also still small. So you can sort of like think you go like a, I go first from x, x, y, you replace the x by x prime, and then you replace the y by y prime. So you have to do it in 2 steps. But then sort of like the states are not very different. So now the idea is sort of if no error was permitted, like epsilon equals to 0 on all pairs x and y, of course this is unrealistic, then you could just replace all of these rho x and y's that they potentially might start with by just rho 0, 0, because they're all the same, right? And then you're back to the setting where you know that your proof is secure, because they just start with a fixed state, no matter what x and y were. And then you just do the normal protocol and it behaves as if it was lossless. So that's great. Now we have to deal with the fact that, well, maybe they do well on some inputs. So on some inputs, they are very good and they never commit wrongly. And on some inputs, they're actually doing very bad. But it's just like if you do this on a few, you just perform badly on a few inputs, then you're probably not detected with high probability. If you're just like wrong on one input pair, then this is almost fine, right? And with this, we have to deal. And now this gives me the opportunity to show like nice graphs, because you can see this as a graph problem. I mean, this x, y, I mean, you should think about like an edge as an input pair x and y. So like red one is x, y, orange is x prime, y, and green is x prime, y prime. So what the theorem before said is you have to do well on x, prime, y, and x prime, y prime. And then you can replace. So sort of like if red, orange, and green is in your graph, then you can basically replace a state which is red by a state which is green. And now I want to say that what happens if the attackers make significant commitment errors, OK, there's an error missing, only on some pairs x and y. And now the ones where they do significant commitment errors, we remove from the graph. So we start with a complete bipartite graph, and now we just erase edges. And then we see like how many can we still reach. That's the idea. So like it's, as I said, it corresponds to erasing edges from this graph. And now we want to erase a fraction c tilde. So we like erase like c tilde times 2 to the 2 n. And we want to say, if I take the sort of the best vertex that is still left, how many edges or how many vertices can I still reach in two steps, right? Because I always need two steps to sort of replace one pair by another one. And I want to sort of replace as many states as I can by the same state. So I need this the biggest set that I can reach. And this is very easy to count. I mean, it took Philip and me quite a while, but in the end, like in hindsight, it's very easy to count. And so if you think about it, there's one x prime, say this one, with at least 1 minus c tilde times 2 to the n edges left. Because otherwise, I mean, we would have erased too many. So if we erase a lot of one edge, then there's one vertex which has a lot of left. So like the best thing that you can do is sort of like erase equally from all of them. Right. So now if you start at this x prime here, you just look, who else can I reach before erasing? So you just look on the right-hand side, I can reach all these guys. And so there used to be 2 to the n edges attached. But now we removed c tilde, 2 to the 2 n of them. So we just subtract them. And then we just count like how many we actually reach now. And if you do this, you get like sort of like you can still reach 1 minus 2 to the c tilde, 2 to the 2 n can still be reached within two steps from x prime. So this means that sort of if the c tilde is not too big, say it's like 0.2 or so, then you can still reach like a constant fraction of what you could reach before. So this is very good. And so this means that sort of like even if we have like a lossy, even if they sort of do bad only on a small fraction, still like we can replace by a constant state on most of the state of the inputs. So this should still work. And now, we look at the set of x and y where the commitment errors are low. That's this one. So like if you see, this is the probability of saying something different. Say Alice says 1 and Bob says 0. And this is the probability of saying Alice says 0, Bob says 1. Those we assume are bounded by epsilon. So this is the set sigma epsilon. This where like was what the graph was. And now the complement of the set is the edges that we erased. So now we can translate this by just using that we can replace by a fixed state. So the statement that if the complement of this set, so the amount of edges that we erased is not too big, then there is a pair x star and y star, okay, before I called this like x prime or so, such that there exist at least 1 minus 2 c tilde, 2 to the n, the thing that we had before, pairs that are within 8 squared of epsilon distance to like a fixed one, to the x star, y star, so let's say 0, 0, 1. So there we can replace, and there we can do well with our protocol, and there we're good. Right, and then we can come to the main result. If we put all of this together and sort of like use a bit of like continuity bounds, then we can prove that if we know epsilon and c tilde, as we had before, then on the rounds, then the attackers commit to play. So we like if they say 0, like I didn't get a qubit, we just ignore that. It's not maybe the best way to do this, but it's an easy way to analyze. So we just say, okay, like we play until we have sort of played a couple of commitment rounds, because if they always say like no qubit, then there's no point in doing this in the first place. So on this rounds that they play, the probability of attacking the protocol, like C QPV is now like the one with commitment, is upper bounded by the attack, by the probability that you could attack this without commitment, so without loss, plus this error term here, which is like depends on C tilde, depends on epsilon. So like if you say C tilde is I don't know, C tilde is something and epsilon is just zero, then this just goes away. Okay, C tilde is also zero in this case to go away. But anyway, so C tilde is small. This would say like these attacks, like the commitment is actually like the loss is actually doesn't change anything. Of course, you can't do that. So now the question is, okay, how do we actually get C tilde and epsilon? Because I always said like sort of this is something that we know, but it depends on the strategy of the attacker. So the attackers won't tell us that, right? And the attackers won't tell us, okay, we're doing badly on a fraction C, and we make this error epsilon. So this is something that we just do for the proof. But now we have to estimate this depending on what we actually, I mean, we're playing this rounds, what the data we get. And there, the idea is the following. So the idea is if we run the protocol a couple of times, like enough times, then the attackers will only escape detection if their commitment error basically everywhere is low on most pairs. Because if stuff like, if they make on many pairs an error, then at some point, if we do this often enough, they like Alice will say 0 and Bob will say 1, and then we say, ah, we found you out. You're actually trying to fool us. Let's not do this. That's the idea. So like if I play this wrong long enough and I never see this 1 says 1 and 1 says 0, then I can conclude from this that sort of like the set where they make a significant error is small, and this error is also small. I mean, like, so if these are interchanged because like in the definition of the sigma epsilon set, we already used the epsilon. So like C and epsilon are basically only one parameter, not two. Anyway, so like what this then looks like is that if you run this protocol like 320 times k cubed times, I mean, this is just like sort of to get nice numbers, of this protocol, then either the attackers are detected with probability bigger than 1 minus 10 to the minus 9, so like pretty surely, or we have the following bound on the probability of attacking a single round protocol, depending only on k. So like this is the same as before. You look at the attack probability of the commitment protocol. It's upper bounded by the attack probability of the lossless one plus 4 divided by k. So the idea is if you want to sort of like make this close enough, you just choose a lot of k. And then, OK, you have to play a lot of rounds. But maybe playing a lot of rounds is not so difficult. And then you get almost the same probability. That's the idea. Anyway. There's a slight caveat here because we can only prove this so far for non-adaptive attacks. So where the sort of if you repeat this in principle, the attackers could look in the past and say, okay, maybe we failed, we succeeded last round and we got this x and we got this y and this state. Maybe this helps us for this round. There's no good reason why it should. It's just like we cannot prove it. So like, but we hope that sort of like with some standard techniques from QKD we can do this. It's basically it's a statistical problem. It's not like so much of a quantum problem. Or maybe we can modify our okay, this is a bold statement, I know. Or maybe we can just make it more slightly complicated to guess like what's going on and hopefully solve that. So this is work in progress, and maybe we solve this week, hopefully. Let's see. So this is like the only thing that sort of like keeps us from actually putting this online. And okay, let's now come to the slide that I'd read. If you have any questions to the experimental realization of this, ask René, because he talked to more experimentalists than I did. And so let's give me like my idea of what the situation is like, whether you can do this or not. So how does the question is now like, how does the honest prover actually know whether she got a qubit or not? Because this is what she has to do, right? I mean, she has to sort of check, did I get a qubit in my postbox? And then say like, if there's a qubit, she says yes. And if there's no qubit, she says no. Of course, she cannot just open her postbox, but she has to do something else. So like theorists that we are, we thought, okay, I mean, there has been a recent demonstration of true non-destructive photon presence detection in a paper by Rempe and others. Let's do that. Looks good. But yeah, at the moment, like they have like a high dark count rate, and like it's experimentally apparently very challenging. It's like cutting edge things. But hopefully these parameters will improve in the future. But, so this is maybe not what you, I mean, if you want to sort of like have a paper next year, maybe this is not what you want. But actually, we can also like do with a lot less. We don't need like this true non-destructive photon presence detection, although of course it would be awesome. But we can like a poor person's version of that. And like the idea is that sort of the prover teleports a photon to herself. If that works, she knows that she has teleported something. If it doesn't work, then she hasn't teleported anything, and there's probably no no qubit. Okay, people are doubting that. But I mean, I was told that in principle this can be realized with linear optics and has been demonstrated in the 90s. And actually, this is experimenting more within reach because, as I said, it's like a standard thing to do, apparently. And we are actually happy with, like, if this only works, like, if there's a qubit and you self-teleport and this only works, like, one of a thousand times, we're actually happy with that. That just, like, it just gets absorbed in the photon loss. We just have to play more rounds. Okay, it's not ideal, but still, I mean, like, in principle, our protocol still works. If we can be sure that sort of if this works, there actually was a qubit. That's the requirement we need. So this should hopefully be doable. I don't say that it's easy, but because I don't know anything about experiments. Right. So like in the end, like the requirements are that I can produce an EPR pair on demand. So I sort of have to sort of generate the EPR pair to teleport to myself. I need to do like a partial Bell state measurement, so sort of know whether the qubit is there or not. I need a short time quantum memory. I mean, I need to sort of like, after I have this, right? I mean, I know I have this qubit, but then there was this time delta t until the x and the y arrive. But this we can hopefully make reasonably short. So I mean, this, I don't know, you take like a couple of hundred meters of cable and then like the qubit just goes around and at some point you have the x and the y, hopefully. That's the idea. And then you have to do measurements depending on the x and the y, which I don't know how difficult this is. Right. So now I hopefully convinced you that we have a fix for the measurement protocol, which is sort of within experimental reach, whatever this means. And so now the question is, like, we have implicitly always assumed that the underlying protocol is this measurement protocol, but we've never used like any properties of that. I mean, not concretely how the protocol works. We just said, okay, like you have this commitment step, you have this delta, and then you run the normal protocol. So maybe you can also like improve other protocols, and this is indeed true. So we only need a few properties in the proof, and one of them is sort of that the protocol that we are looking at can deal with slow quantum information, so like not the routing, for example. And the prover has to return classical bits because otherwise you still have the problem of photon loss on your way back and haven't really won anything. So if you have such a protocol, then in principle you can do the same thing, this commitment thing, and you're good. So in principle, like we have to figure out this out explicitly, what it actually mean, but morally, I mean, this is sort of what you want. So if you have a protocol that is not a measuring protocol, which has its properties, and you want to sort of do it in a lab, then you can still use our result to say, okay, I can at least forget about the photon loss. So we have found like a general method to make such protocols fully tolerant against photon loss, which is very nice. And let me conclude with some open questions. I mean, they're just the ones that I sort of came to me like at 1 a.m. Today. So this is probably not the list that, I mean, I'm not convinced that these are the most interesting ones or the most relevant ones, but there are some. So I mean, first, I said, I mean, we have this lower bounds of log n for concrete functions, say for the inner product function, but at least you want something linear. This should work. I mean, this should be like an artifact of our proof method, so there should be a way to sort of modify the proof and then prove at least linear lower bounds against, say, the inner product function. So this would be nice to do. I don't know how, but I mean, would be nice. We always counted dimensions, so like we counted just number of qubits that the attackers have. But I mean, it should matter what state they actually share. I mean, if they share like n EPR pairs, that should help them more than just sharing like a completely like a pure product state, right? I mean, the pure product state shouldn't have helped anyone. So maybe you want to replace this dimension by an entanglement measure of your liking. I don't limit you there. You can take anything that you want. We want to prove, of course, parallel repetition, which the swap test can do, but which we can't do yet, at least. That would be nice. And of course, you want to have like super polynomial lower bounds. Well, I mean, you don't need to be motivated by me to do that. So let me conclude. What have we seen? We've seen like that the measuring protocol is a very simple protocol with one qubit only for the honest prover. It's secure against a linear amount of entanglement, and you can sort of like force the attackers to use more and more qubits to attack it. It can be made fully loss tolerant by adding this commitment part that I think, if I remember correctly, sort of originated actually also like in a discussion between, I think, Harry, Florian, and Adrian at this workshop that Adrian organized, I think, pre-COVID. And so like everything in the end goes back to Adrian. I mean, like, you can do nothing new. It's already been done. And the honest prover, however, does not need more quantum resources. I mean, sort of, you can make it difficult for the attackers, but you yourself are safe. And which, okay, seems experimental but feasible in principle. Right. And so, like, if we want to have like a one statement summary of this, we can make many QPV protocols loss tolerant by adding a commitment step. So that's it. I'll just show you some of the references that appeared here, if you're interested. So if you have questions, please.
Lots of questions here.
Oh my god.
Maybe we start with Adrian, because it was his birthday yesterday.
That's a good argument.
Could you say what the obstacles are setting the parallel?
With the parallel repetition, you mean? Well, I mean, like, if you think about, like, for which protocols can we actually show parallel repetition? Like, for example, you take this paper by Thomas Michel et al., where they look at these monogamy of entanglement games, and you show that you can parallel repeat those. But there they can sort of show that the optimal strategy doesn't actually use any entanglement. And then, like, if you have no entanglement, then you can just parallel repeat, and then you're good. And also, like, if you look at this paper by Beghi and Koenig, they also analyzed this the no prior entanglement protocol, and then they show later that sort of like if you add entanglement, sort of the probability cannot change that much. But we cannot do this because you can always guess with 50% being right where to send the qubit or what to measure. So like this sort of road is closed to us. So I mean, what you would need is you would need a way to sort of prove security of this protocol for unentangled attackers first, and then lift this to the entangled attackers. At least this would be one way to do this, which then probably allows you to prove repetition. But the proof that I presented very much doesn't work like this. So I mean, if I would, like, I don't know, give this problem to a student or so, I would suggest to first like reprove our thing, but like where you first analyze the no entanglement case and then the entanglement case. I'm not sure if this works. There's probably other ways to do it.
The notion of teleporting to oneself as a way of doing a QPV is kind of interesting.
Right.
The question is, does it hurt you the fact that that's by definition, you know, 50% efficient and probably a lot?
Now, this is what I try to explain. I think if it has a high probability to actually fail, that's not a problem. I mean, like, then you just have to play the game for a bit longer. Like, the only problem that we need is that sort of if it succeeds, you can be reasonably sure that there was a qubit. Sort of, if you have this problem, sort of like sometimes it succeeds, but you cannot actually be sure that there was a qubit, then you haven't won anything. But sort of, if the whole procedure fails from most of the time, that's fine. This is why we thought that maybe like this is a viable thing to do. But I mean, you know definitely better than me if this can be done. Wolfgang? Oh, sorry.
Yeah. Or Eric.
Sorry, I shouldn't interfere with this.
Question. So when you have this idea of maybe generalizing to all types of protocols, I guess it has to be a protocol, though, where the prover sends classical messages to the verifiers.
Yes. I mean, okay, let's maybe go back to this. My aim is not to generalize it to all of them. It's just like we observe that sort of this is protocol agnostic, reasonably. Right. No, I think this was this. So like the two things are like slow quantum information. Oh. So you have to be able to replace the state that Alice and Bob can start with, because sort of this is what this graph thing does. It just replaces by something else, so necessarily what you started with. So it can look completely different than the honest protocol. But if you already can deal with this, then you're good. And as you said, the prover has to return classical bits.
Yeah.
This is the second thing. I mean, both of these things, for example, speak against the routing. I'm not sure if like things like your protocol can deal with this, but if you have such a protocol and sort of you like it, you can do this.
Sorry, this is just a basic question.
Sure.
The point where you had the instrument, and then you said, okay, I can convert this to this EI.
Right.
And then you said you were putting the EI in the protocol. I just don't understand what that meant, I guess.
All right, okay. I mean, it just means that, okay, let's I'm almost there. Exactly. You mean this statement, right?
Yeah.
So now you have a quantum channel here, right? And the quantum channel, okay, in priori depends on the outcome of the measurement, but we only look at the case. I mean, we only play if the outcome has to be one, right? So this sort of like is always it's always the same channel in some sense. It can depend like locally on x and locally on y, but not on x and y. So sort of like this then looks like they sort of measure the stuff first, and then they apply a channel locally, Alice, depending on X, to her side, and locally, Bob on Y on his side. Or you can say, okay, like before we only had unitaries, okay, but then you do like Stein spring dilation, that doesn't change anything. So by like with us, a lot of loss of generality, this is a unitary channel. But then it just means like, okay, I apply a unitary depending on X and a unitary depending on Y. But this was part of my attacks to begin with, right? I mean, that doesn't really change anything. So I can just take a cut, like, okay, like anything that comes before that is like part of the preparation. Everything that comes after that is part of the lossless protocol. And since you already know that this cannot help you, then you're good.
Okay, that makes sense.
That's the idea. Thanks for asking.
A question about the gentle measurements. Do you mean weak measurements with this?
No, it's just like it's called the gentle measurement lemma. It's just like an ordinary measurement. Exactly, like it's just like how people call that. I think gentle measurement because if you look at this, what this measurement does, it's sort of like it succeeds with very high probability, and then it doesn't change, it doesn't really disturb the state.
Yeah, but this cannot work, right? Then you would learn the quantum state fully.
Yeah, but it doesn't tell you so much, right? I mean, it almost always accepts, right? So sort of like if you just extract very few information from this.
But this motivated the point for the other thing, weak measurements, so where the initial and final state is nearly orthogonal, so the measurement nearly never succeeds. Mm. But if it succeeds, you get quite some information about your state. Is this covered in your attack analysis?
No, I don't think so.
Yeah, but I was wondering, because the attackers could always, if it doesn't succeed, throw away or pretend loss of the states.
I mean, this is what the commitment is supposed to prevent, right?
Yeah, sure.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay,
thanks.
Okay, then, well, I guess we're done for lunch. So thank you very much, Jacob.